to the planning commission meeting dated Tuesday, January 28th, 7 p.m. at the Community Recreation Center in Spiritos, Utah. The first order of business is the appointment of a chair and a vice chair. To be honest, I didn't see this on the agenda for this now. So I guess we are seeking nominations or board chair and vice chair.
Can I make a comment?
Yeah.
For some reason, I thought I saw the city council agenda.
Yeah.
Was discussion about just having the mayor make those appointments or something.
We talked about that, and we're not going to do that, and so we're still having the council approve the chair, vice chair. The mayor and council, they're going through all of the bylaws for all of the committees and commissions. So you have, yours is just first. They're also doing even the YCC, the Youth City Council, as well as the Economic Festival Committee. I'll be honest, there was a concern just that I know Chairman Drakes has been absent a lot. Just they wanted to make sure that we had a chairman that was here for the majority of the meetings. That was it. But I think my recommendation to the mayor was to give the planning commission the autonomy to appoint their own chair. And so that's why it's still, nothing has changed.
Do you want to nominate anybody for chair or vice chair?
Yes, I would like to nominate Jeff Dodge for chair.
I will second that. So, does anybody else want to nominate a chair? We have more than a vote, so does anybody else want to nominate anybody else for chair? So, all those in favor say aye for John Drakes to be chair.
No.
Jeff Dodge.
Jeff Dodge.
Chair Dodge. Jeff Dodge. Okay. That's what I'm saying. Sorry. So, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Any opposed? That?
Nice.
We have another vice. So, now we will take nominations for vice chair. All those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Okay, so, yeah, I'm sure you're going to be listening.
This title might be hereditary.
Is that right?
Just messing with it.
Following
its
footsteps again.
Yeah,
that's weird. All right, so nominations for item number 3 on our agenda here for public comment. We've set aside time for any public comment. For anyone who signed up, I don't see anyone here. Seeing none, we'll move on then to close the public comment section. We'll run out of four.
I'd also recognize Jared Anderson.
Are we ready? Jared? Recognize Jared Anderson as a voting member this evening. Keep coaching me. I'll get around eventually. Item 4, approval of the minutes from our October 29 and November 26. Planning Commission meetings. First, I guess the October 29 meetings. Any comments on those 8 minutes? Seeing none, any comments on the November 26 commission meeting minutes? Seeing none there, I'll entertain a motion.
I move that we approve the minutes from the October 29th and November 26th, 2019 Planning Commission meetings. I'll second.
Sure. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, departed? Okay. Well, we'll move on to item 5, discussion on fences adjacent to public parks. For trails and certain streets. This is my staff.
Staff is requesting planning commission address and discuss certain current fencing codes 10518 with specific to special permissions to fences that are adjacent to public parks, trails, and major streets. This is a discussion item only. No proposal for the code will be presented. Any proposed code or changes will be subject to planning commission and city council approval. A little background on this. Mayor Reese requested that staff address changes in language that address fencing requirements for this section of the code. There was also repeatedly residents that expressed a desire to be able to more fully enclose their property that are adjacent to park trails or major street. Currently, they're not able to alter these under the current code. Some of the property owners' complaints are, and these are more specific, I put a parks and trail map in front of you. Most of these are between Harvey Boulevard that go up to through Heritage Park and then over to Redwood Road. So that those are the, mainly the most of the complaints that have came in is through those areas. One, the residents feel a lack of privacy and the amount of noise when patrons access the trails or using the trails there. The other one is the current open style fence requirement. A homeowner that has a child or a pet that's in the yard, if a patron comes by with a, another animal and it's not leashed or it's loose, that it causes quite a bit of contention between the dog will go after either the child or the pet, causing a lot of ruckus. And if the dog is small enough, it can fit through the fence. Another issue that we've had is that these dogs have gone through the fence and defecated onto the neighboring property, and then they leave. Being said that the owners of the pets won't go after and clean them up because they have to jump that small open fence to go get it out. They feel like this limits the full use of their property. One of the examples is if a particular resident would like to do a pool installation of a sports court, etc., or other items on their property that would require some type of security or safety fencing, the city would limit the homeowners to be able to do so on these properties. Another issue we've had is vandalism and criminal activity because the property, the patrons that go through the park can see everything in the park. So these are the issues that have come about as well. Like I say, these are mostly through the high frequency areas through the parks there system. The original intent of the fencing code indicates it is the intent of the section to establish minimum standards for the placement and height of fences for the purpose of facilitating safety of pedestrians and motor vehicle users in connection with ingress and egress to private drives or parking areas and more adequately protecting the health, safety, and welfare of the population. And while these fence heights are okay for areas that would be a safety issue for pedestrians and motor vehicles, makes sense. Homeowners that border these specific areas are subject to, you know, quite a bit of stringent fencing regulations. The intent for special provisions relating to parks, if you go on our city code under this particular section, the intent there of this subsection is to establish certain standards for the construction of fences adjacent to public parks, trails, corridors, and certain major traffic arteries that are highly visible to the public for the purpose of achieving and coordinated appearance and consistent quality design and construction of such facilities. Again, when looking at these parks and trails, you can see designated where these trails begin on the map. The red is, So your red is your current trail map, and then the proposed trail, which runs up along Silver Lake Drive and Canyon Heights, that's proposed trail, or currently it's Bonneville Shoreline Trail right now. When the subdivisions borders upon these existing or proposed parks or trails or major streets, a fence conforming with these standards in subsection 10.5.18f of the code will be constructed along the common boundary between lots of parks and trails. Meaning, basically, these, again, these properties are higher restrictions than other fences relating to trails. So, meaning, material, which is stated, is either white, tan, gray vinyl, of any style or shape, wrought iron, black, brown, and color, and type of pipe, they have some restrictions as well. We would like to open this up to discussion tonight for different options that we can have for these homeowners if this is something, a direction that we would like to go.
Thanks. Comments?
So there are portions of our city where I see either stone fencing along sidewalks and such. I don't see that in codes and basic fence. If I'm wrong, about the what we call for the vinyl, white and gray vinyl fencing.
Wait, where is this? Sorry?
By Deerfield Elementary, there's a neighborhood there.
Oh,
has
yes. You're talking, you're talking to HOA specifically there.
This is Cedar Hills.
Yes.
Right. So they get their own fencing rules, even though they're Cedar Hills.
What do you mean?
It's a gated community, right?
Yeah, it's a gated community. We allow concrete fences.
That's what I thought. I didn't see it before.
But the code here is really only just adjacent to trails.
Okay.
So, but your point is still valid because as you in that specific subdivision, as you go along Harvey Boulevard, no big deal. But as you turn up Forest Creek Trail, that is where we're talking about specifically. And they've added a concrete fence there. But they did. It's just they put it in.
They did. One of the things that that they were looking to do is to put a pool into this area, and they wanted a privacy type pool. So they didn't put it on the property line. They put it inside of their property line, and that's where the placement.
So they'll double up your fence. So you'll have an open vinyl fence, and then just on the other side of it, they'll raise their backyard and put a pool in there, and then it'll just have a concrete block wall, which makes the code of having open fencing seem a little redundant.
So with full disclosure, I'm in favor of allowing people on these paths to have a privacy fence. And I will pull the plunger. I live next door to these trails, and I have a chain fence that's open. I see everybody who comes by, they see me running by, they can see in my backyard, my dogs, and I will rush to the fence and get the other pets and have a barking session for a while. I'm always concerned that the dog's going to get out of the yard and who knows what. So I'm living in the storage and just talking about this whole thing. So I would be,
I also agree with David. I have blocked the trails many times on the path behind my home. And I worry that, not to think that if that was my yard, I probably wouldn't use that patio as much. I wouldn't be barbecuing out there. I wouldn't be having my kids play out there without me watching. Especially, in the summer and in the night. So I'm for allowing them.
People on those trails 24 hours a day.
But the intent, let me just clarify, was so that we weren't just having a solid tunnel of white or vinyl fencing, which would be dangerous if you were there and you were, understand that.
There's really only one spot where that could, has, is happening, and that's as you go Harvey leading onto Forest Creek Trail. There's a spot, it's maybe 400 feet long. It's just a straight shot up to the, really where the trail opens up a little bit more. In the past, the what we've always talked about is that this is a safety issue, but I think the safety goes both ways, actually. Like, I see a safety issue for having the fence, and I see a safety issue for not having the fence. But we have seen, strangely enough, we have seen an increase in like dog bites and dog attacks on the trail over the years. And I don't know if they're coming from the residents' home there. I don't know if they're just people on the trail having their animals unleashed. We've tried to put an effort into saying, please leash your animals. But it does present some problems. Either way.
So let me ask a question. I think when I read through this, it looks like 3B is part of the restriction that we're talking about. And 3B looks like only applies where the trail segment is greater than 130 feet in length and less than 30 feet in width, so as to avoid, you know, this 400 foot long. Everywhere else, I'm not sure what the requirement is. Because 3B, if it only applies to those locations, it's only in those locations where they're restricted to 4 foot tall or open up to 6 feet. Everywhere else on the trails or next parks, as long as the width of the trail area is greater than 30 feet or the length is less than 130 feet, in other words, a pinch point or whatever, they can do the open 6 foot fence or 4 foot.
Or a closed 6 foot. It
looks like
it. If you look further down.
If it's not in that area, yeah, that's right.
If you look further down on section B, it says fence standards as specified elsewhere in this section apply with planning commission approval. So I think at that point, they would have to get planning commission's approval.
I was here when that code was passed. That was specifically to address where a trail system is adjacent to a major road. Because if your argument is safety and maintaining visibility, then having a privacy fence doesn't increase the visibility when it's adjacent to a major road because you're adjacent to a major road. So it became a conditional use permit for people to be able to put in a privacy fence when their property bordered a trail slash major or arterial road. To date, there's been no applications for that. So one of the notes I've made is that if this code were to change, if we were to say we're going to allow privacy fences adjacent to all trails, regardless of whether or not they're next to a street or not, that would be one of the other kind of concurrent changes that would have to be made in the code just to make sure that CUP process is eliminated, really. Because you're at that point, you're saying they're allowed.
So do we not already allow a 6 foot privacy fence unless 3B applies?
Not if they're on this specific trail now, if they're adjacent to
the fence.
It has to be open.
You're open up to no greater than 6 feet where the trail is less than 30 feet wide.
Yeah. So all of that, I think staff's on board. Like all that language would just pretty much be eliminated. And it'd be treated just under the standard fencing code for the city.
Our only restriction that it seems like we're leaving 3 feet is we're only trying to do. I have some comments on a couple other things, but. just in terms of how we describe material.
Well, I understand the security concerns. Like when I bought my house, there wasn't a trail in the basement property yet. Now, I'm looking at this building, which I knew may happen someday, by the way, when I bought my house, but it happened like 8 years after I bought my house. But I've taken a few security measures because I'm concerned people, you know, if they easily access my property and take something.
So, Chandler, back to the safety issue. What is the safety concern with a privacy fence or non-privacy fence adjacent to the trail?
Lorianne touched on it, just creating visibility in the public areas. That's kind of been the argument over the years. And to be frank, I don't know that it's that big of an issue. There just hasn't been a...
Do you have to foster visibility by not having fences in public areas?
Well, that's just what that's kind of, maybe it's apocryphal, I don't know, but that's kind of been the reason that's been handed down to me is like, this is why these aren't allowed next to trails, is because of safety. Now, I haven't seen any studies or anything that backs that up, that it creates a more safer environment. I think that it does, on some level, create a more challenging environment for the property owner to fully enjoy their property when they live adjacent to a trail. Like, there's definitely a sacrifice that's made there on their part by having to have an open fence or no fence.
I think I'm a little less sympathetic to that, with all due respect to those who may fall in that category. I mean, that's a land use issue in general. When you buy your house there, you're subject to whatever the restriction is.
Around you, correct.
And so now, after the fact, complain that you don't like them cuts against certain policies.
However, I think that it can be flexible. We can amend it when there is a need, and there is a apparent need for safety.
I need to create one safety issue for another safety issue. So there's concern of property owners having people being able to gaze through their yards and kids and things. I'm not attributing constructors in any instances that happen, but a privacy fence may be the other safety where the premise there is that if you're on the trail and you're walking or jogging, and presuming that people can see you from those homes, they may not be messy, right? So I think you're creating one safety issue for another one. I generally try to side with property rights whenever I can, and I kind of feel like, again, full disclosure, I live on the trail, right? But I think it'd be great if you gave the property owners the ability to secure their yards and feel better about this yard and have a good experience.
So let me ask this again. How much of this trail does really need to fight in terms of being less than the reason I'm asking that is at a minimum, if we can allow anywhere along the trail that's wider than 30 feet to have a privacy fence, is that enough? Or do we, and then you handle where it's less than 30 feet on an as needed basis, or do we need to complete it really?
Let's first concentrate on the 30 for that speed. So if you go up Harvey Boulevard, and like I say, it goes all the way up to Redwood Drive there. Then you have a small section if you turn east on Redwood Drive, going up to Cottonwood. You can go up to, and the trail will split to the west, and then it comes back up another home, and then splits to the right. So that small section that goes from Cottonwood up to Joshua Lane.
I'm sorry. I've got no street names on here.
Okay,
all.
Here.
It's by the point one, though.
So if you go by point one.
Up here. Okay.
Right there?
Yes.
Okay. So in that particular point is where the trail will split up on Cottonwood.
But that's just open sidewalk.
That's just open sidewalk. But you've got a path greater than 30 feet at that point. But then when you come to this point right here, from this section here and this smaller section, it would affect those two areas. The other area would affect is Bay Hill Park area. That's where I'm missing.
So we have two small areas that currently would suffer under 3 feet.
Correct. And there is a small one that's between Sandalwood and Oak. It's right here in the middle. At this point, there's a small section.
I mean, one way to look at this is anywhere where the path is less than 30 feet in the width is where we think there's a safety issue on the path. And so we've enacted 3 feet. Anywhere where the pathway width is greater than 30 feet, we thought, well, that's not so much a safety issue. So we allow 6-foot fence so far. It's
But they were still open type.
Right. So one step for what we're hearing from the community is to allow them to have a 6-foot closed fence wherever the path is wider than 5 feet, because we don't think that affects safety on the path. So that would allow a lot of people to have a 6-foot closed fence. It still doesn't help these three areas that you've identified where the path is less than.
The areas that have the biggest amount of complaints and traffic is from this point to this point.
Right.
It's through that area.
But I'm just thinking out loud.
The path from Heritage Park down to Martin Boulevard, I've probably walked that maybe 150 times. Because that's the path that our family follows when we go for our walks. And three comments. First of all, the safety issue, I think, is not. I think it's highly overrated, because when all the incidents that I've read about in the last couple of years of people being attacked on paths have not taken place in closed areas. They've taken place in larger areas where there was bushes or trees and somebody jumped out of the taxi. So I don't think this is going to affect that at all. Second, I think the reason we want to open fences and not fences is because it makes the path right here. And with all due respect to those who are living there, keeping these gorgeous backyards that we're looking at as we walk by, to me, it's more of a, I don't like walking along by a wall for a half a mile. Having said that, I've had a swimming pool in my backyard for 18 years. Okay. You have to have a privacy fence. You cannot get homeowners insurance if you do not. So we are effectively saying you can't have a pool. And I don't think that's right. Just simple, you know, facts. I think that's just not fair. And I'm very sympathetic to it. Commissioner Drake said, I would not want anybody walking along like I do to these other people, looking in their backyards, you know, calling out their dogs. And we're friendly, we don't egg them on, but if you've got a dog, it could get excited by people walking in the path and having a privacy fence. Not too much to ask.
Can I throw something out there?
Sure.
We keep talking about this 30-foot width. Right? And as you walk through if you walk along the Forest Creek Trail, really from its beginning point up by Redwood, up by this point 1-1, down to its completion as it hits, comes into Harvey Park, there's only a couple spots where if you take in the actual width of the trail area, like the trail itself, plus the creek, plus any native vegetation, there's only a couple spots where we're talking that it's less than 30 feet, right? One of those spots is down here just south of Sunset Park as it heads south. One thing I'm thinking about is if safety is the concern, what is it about safety that you're trying to enhance? And it's the visibility, right? Well, if visibility is the concern, from Harvey Boulevard, I can see all the way up this trail, right? So safety really shouldn't be a concern. Even though they've put in some solid fencing there, the width there is, I just looked, it's like slightly less than 20 feet. But it's visible from a major road that's traveled heavily for Cedar Hills. However, as you turn west, it's kind of still remains a choke point there, but it's less visible. So you could also add in provisions about if it's visible from a roadway, if it's visible in some manner, that it could be excluded from some of these privacy, from some of these open fencing requirements. Just thinking.
Other comments? I'll entertain a motion.
You're still going to have to table it, or we're going to come back. This is just a discussion. I think we just wanted to.
About this. Now, I don't think that, it doesn't come up near that. I'm talking about the homes that are that we have as we come into this area.
Yeah.
Those that just HOA, they can have a privacy fence as we fade back onto this road.
Which HOA? They are not allowed, their HOAs, CCNRs do not allow them to have privacy fences. They have brick pillars, but I mean, when we talk about privacy, when we talk about an open fence, we're talking that it's 40% open. So theirs are drastically more than 40% because they're required to have wrought iron.
Okay.
Yeah, kind of a different situation though.
Just one thing to further think about on the material 3A. Wrought iron is not really what we're talking about. It's really a painted steel and painted aluminum, painted metal. I don't know if we can find wrought iron somewhere or if somebody wants to twist and turn on that, they can, or if we just want to find it, but it really is a painted metal.
And I know on the HOA over on the Cedars West, they do have a verbiage that does call out that we need to pay the wrought iron for that. Quite a bit of that moving out of the area.
It is. And it's mostly painted steel, you see the rust. And I have it in my backyard. So. But we may want to just clarify what we mean by wrought iron. You rarely see wrought iron anymore.
I would add that you should leave wrought iron.
And that's why. Wrought iron plus. Yeah. Sure. So wrought iron and or? Yeah, painted metal. Painted aluminum is the best, but it's a little more than painted steel, And then the first part of the sentence talks as the fence shall be white, tan, or gray vinyl. We may want to say any vinyl fence shall be white, tan, or gray in color.
If they have the option.
If we're going to have, I hope we define the color for that too.
We say brown or black. So, and then 3B, I would just propose considering the idea that we can do a 6-foot privacy fence. And we'll discuss this further. The property owners that I'm going to direct to more are the ones who actually own the residences adjacent to the track. I realize that they. When they buy the property, they know that they're up against the trail and they're on the street. I am sympathetic to the privacy issues.
I would add, as well, let's cut this back for a further discussion or vote or whatever, that we consider if we do allow for privacy fencing along those pathways that we maybe also have. So,
that's all very nice.
Some concrete fencing is also listed for the pathways. So that's what they asked for.
Right, they don't want to block. But yeah.
So I'm assuming under 3A is where we would want to place that in Wolfell Creek, right?
Yeah, we have to discuss exactly how we describe those materials. That's right. I would hesitate to just do straight CMU, but you know, a split face block or a solid slope. And then we'll move on to item 6, discussion on design standards for driveways and slopes.
So staff is looking to update this portion of city code to align it with our current building code and with past codes or amendments that have been made to city codes relating to driveways. This discussion would be specific to driveway slopes and referring to current city codes, residential driveways only. So this would not include any commercial type of properties. On this, staff is requesting the Planning Commission consider addressing this amendment and to amend this code. Again, this is a discussionary item. Let me give you a little bit of background behind this. As you're aware, that some areas or lots within the city have steep slopes. These present challenges for developers to try to fit the homes on these parcels, not having a flat topography. We are aware that these are more relevant on the hillside area than any other place in the city, but we do have some within the city that would fall under this category as well. Lots having a steeper topography have created the necessity to install a steep driveway in order to access the homes built higher than average on the lot. I was made aware on a previous home construction, if you look up on Canyon Heights, some of the steep slope driveways up in that area have a greater than 8% grade, and some grades may be allowed up to 12% stretches. These were in the past were allowed if they did a COVID compliant safety stairway on the side of the driveway areas. With future construction in this hillside area and recent situations to a homeowner that installed a very steep driveway in the community, I contested the building department, and he did not want these code compliant stairs on this driveway area. We want to mitigate these safety issues, and staff request planning commission to amend code and establish standards and more specific guidelines for these driveway slopes. This will also help mitigate, again, potential hazards and unsafe conditions for future installation of these driveways when they occur. Currently, the code language, which this would affect, is 10.5-5, development code, section A and B. Under the supplementary standards, it would affect 10-55, A-14, and C-5. This is reference to front and side setback areas. It would affect 10-4D-8, buildable area required in the hillside development zone. 11-5-2, design requirements. Documentation and design requirements. 10-6D-8, design criteria for planned townsite projects, and 10-6B-7, design criteria for planned residential buildings. The city code is very vague on all aspects of driveway slopes and design standards. Currently, staff is looking at possibly updating design standards and public improvement specifications to meet current building codes, to line also with city code. The last time this was updated, this is our book here, was back in October 2006. It does need to be amended at some point. Depending on the steepness of the driveway approach, will also create safety aspects and hazard for public safety crew that need to respond to a home in the event of emergency. One of the things that we have gone up against, in particular this one driveway, is we requested the advice of American Fort Fire Marshal to come out and evaluate the steep slope in this area. One of the things that he indicated to us that he would not want or allow hose or rescue crews to use driveway with steep driveways for access during an emergency in the event it would bring some type of hazard to the crew. Difficulty or impossibility to get their equipment, their apparatuses up there, and to access that driveway without these code compliance steps that are no longer available. So our, in addition, building official Jeff Mock referenced section R311 of the 2015 International Residential Code. A means of egress requires that a door shall open directly into a public way or to a yard or court that opens into a public way. A yard is defined as an open space rather than a court, unobstructed from the ground to the sky on the lot on which the building is situated. In the case that driveways are overly steep, the city has a requirement to install code compliant steps to create safe access for not only homeowners, but again, for emergency crew. And this would again meet IRC code compliant steps requirements. However, again, city code or building code that requires the installation of these steps. Staff has recommended that the planning commission review these, create some type of language addressing steep slopes. We've just gone through and we've created the depth and the width and everything that we need to at that point, but we didn't have that situation at this time with the steep slopes. We're almost built out on the east side, but there still is room for construction for more slope driveways in the area. So we want to accommodate that. We want to mitigate these before they actually come out for any type of safety issues. Again, this is not a motion, it's discretionary by the public, so any comments?
I have one. At the present time, is there anywhere in our code where we talk about slope in specific numbers?
We do talk specifically about slope. It comes up.
Because I read through this quickly. This is the long one. Is it which?
So 10.6.7.
Yeah.
Which is virtually the same as 10.6.B. And I think the language there is more confusing. I didn't quite understand what they meant.
So I think one of the things we'd like to do is clarify how it is.
I'm looking at 1067 and 405. I'm not seeing a drive.
Well, it's saying, it says no private, it's common driveway, private driveway. No private driveway within the PRD.
Yes.
Can't create a slope that exceeds the critical angle of the code or is greater than 5 feet. And I didn't know whether, is that, when it says not greater than 5 feet, what does that mean? Is that a cross slope?
I didn't understand that.
They're from the top of the driveway to the bottom. And the critical angle of the pose, I think that varies depending on what type of soil they're building on.
There's a lot of variability in that.
Yeah.
But also 5 feet, if you're looking at 5 feet of change, it doesn't, if you're taking it at a vertical 5 feet, and a quick drive around the city, you'll find that many driveways have a greater height variation from the street to the top of the driveway of 5 feet. So that's kind of a ridiculous number if we're being honest. But really what it comes down to is that our code allows up to 8%. Our design standards allow for some provisions up to 12%, right? Which is a steep driveway. We had a driveway that was installed, and it's a long story and I'm not going to get into the details, but portions of the slope are north of 30. So this was the situation that the fire marshal came to us and said, look, if there is an emergency in that house is on fire and this is iced over, I can't get an apparatus up here, right? And so we worked with the people saying, look, you built your home too high, your foundation, it's like a simple, it's simple geometry. From the face of the street, if you build your house higher than what was approved, that's a steeper angle than what was approved, right? This is what happened. In this case, we requested that they put in some code compliance steps so that in the case of an emergency, fire marshal or the public safety personnel could access the home safely. They balked at the idea and didn't want to do it. And we don't have any teeth in our code to say you have to do that. So really what we're asking is, there are situations in our city where in the H1 zone, specifically on the hillside, there are situations where steep driveways do exist and will be built, right? So we're saying, give us the ability to say, yeah, you can have a steeper driveway. It has to be approved by the correct officials, but also it needs to be accompanied by code compliance steps. That's really what this comes down to.
I mean, I don't want to over-restrict. I know when we design parking lots and roadways, 8% is is max you like to hit, and that's in an approach drive that then levels out. You would never park on anything more than 5%. Even at about 5%, if you were getting out of your car, the door keeps shutting, or grandma and grandpa are trying to get out of the car, or your 5-year-old on a 5% slope, the door just keeps shutting on them. That's a typical rule. 12% is.
12% is steep.
That's way up there. I realize the hillside zone, if we're being proactive about this, smart. We are going to end up with some steeper things. So I like the idea of, you know, finding a way to mitigate it, except that it's probably going to happen at the time of finding a way to help mitigate it. So we feel okay with emergency personnel, obviously.
And that was the main reason why we brought them in, to get their opinion on the matter.
I would add that if it's a steep driveway, there should be some pedestrian access, whether the steps are on the driveway or whether you have some steps for the house and certain just accessibility. So I don't know what the requirement should be, except that can be on the driveway. But there should be steps of a certain width or whatever you need access to the house. Now I can see fire marshal might want to drive his truck up the driveway, I suppose. That's the case. I know I think steps of the driveway are up on the driveway, but
well, if they're unable to access the driveway, they're coming through with it. Like I say, that if the driveway is iced over at any point, then it doesn't seem problematic.
Is there in the code, do we require steps?
No.
For the house?
No.
No?
So that's what we're thinking. Yeah. We come up with a I think you have a mitigation effort of some kind and also an approval process above 12%.
So above 12%, if it's above 12%, I would personally like to have the mayor council approve that with recommendation from the public safety personnel, specifically the fire marshal, with the condition, typically, I'm certain there's going to be some exception, but typically, if not always, with adjacent steps leading to the first, to give it a safe area to walk.
Question, like, is it adjacent? They can be
next to the driveway. Just I don't care where they are. They can go up the side of the driveway, and then once you get to a slope that's, you know, moderate, like 5% in this case, you can obviously walk across and no problem. But I mean, if you're going up steps, in this case where we had a 30%, and the 30% wasn't the extent of the driveway. It was really just small stretches. But those small stretches, as you're designing roads, and I think Chairman Dodge can appreciate this, as you're designing roads, you don't want to have it so steep that as that angle changes that you pot them out or you grind your bumper along the base. So sometimes you have to plan roads that are a little bit steeper than 8%, but you have to do it for small stretches. So like on Lakeshore Drive, which is off of Canyon Road, we have a small stretch of roadway there that is about at 8%, but we had to make it steep on the backside so that as you approach the stop sign, you're not coming down into the road at a very steep angle. You have a K value there that you want to have, be able to have cars queue up before they get into the street, into the roadway. Well, your approach to your driveway is very similar. You want to be able to pull into your driveway and not bottom out as you hit the road. But yeah, the steps should just be adjacent to the home, adjacent to the driveway in some manner. Really, it doesn't matter how they do it. It just has to, if you're going to cross the driveway, it has to be in a spot where it's at a decent angle.
Okay. So, Jake, not just the ones that maybe over in front of the house, close the door. So
it could be those two. It could be those two. Anything. Any steps will accept.
Okay.
So, going up the hill or down the hill to the Cedars, there are six-room homes where Bay Hill goes into Cottonwood.
Right.
And they haven't really chosen to have high foundations on the one side. It's just because of the slope of the mountain that they've got to set their homes up higher. One in particular a double or triple driveway that is well exceeding 30%. I mean, this is the whole thing. And I, he probably had some kind of PE things put underneath, I would think, for ice and snow, but that could be an issue. I can't remember if there's any kind of stairway over the side. I don't think
I'm not familiar.
Sidewalk going
in. But at the same time, I don't have code that says you have to put in a driveway. You don't. You have to put in a code compliance step. So the problem is when you get to the point that they're looking for a certificate of occupancy for their home, they've built their driveway. They're way past their foundation. They're looking to finish the home and start moving the couch in. And at that point, you're going to say, "Hey, you built your house too high. Let's knock it down and start over 3 feet lower." Like you've got to be practical too. So. That's why we want to say at that point something that you can do retroactively is saying, okay, well your foundation is too high, which led to your driveway being too steep. The result is that in order to get your CFO, put in steps.
Yeah, but I guess my question is, will there be some type of
can't be retroactive
action saying, you know, this emergency thing is an issue?
We can,
like, you consider having some kind of stairs.
Are you talking about homes that are currently out of compliance?
Yes.
Homes that are currently out of compliance, there's no way that we can retroactively post-date the ordinance. We can address it in that we recognize that your driveway is too slow. This could create a situation for public safety personnel responses and leave it at that.
Yeah, I guess it would kind of
that's
be,
about it.
By way of... notification or something. Because the other one across the street, the opposite, that is way down on the slope, recently built a circular driveway, and half of that is just like almost right down.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. I don't think there's any steps on that one either. Sorry, thanks.
Mr. Rick just killed me. Do you think if he was like in the 50s, he'd be a beatnik pro?
We're going to go back to the clarification. We do want to go back and address more things.
Yeah, I think that the items that were mentioned, I think I do kind of support the chairman, the idea of mitigating something in the code, such as the stairwell. And you might say a stairwell that leads from the main entry to a public way. And that would require them to go down to the sidewalk. And then also perhaps approval by City Council with the recommendation of emergency personnel for any driveway slope that exceeds 12% currently.
8%.
12%. I mean, we currently allow up to 12%.
Up to 8, really.
Well, the
code says 12.
So I thought somebody said
it's both. If you look at the code says this is the vagaries here that we're trying to clear up, because the code says 12, but the design standards say 8.
Well, what about this? Since both are in there, can you look a little bit and see that it do two things. Either look at what other cities may have mandated similar lists with this subdistrict outlier. Island, perhaps, or is there a standard out there about a driveway standard?
Not necessarily. This is the issue.
We've looked at.
Yeah. So there's not.
There's not a standard that's shared widely throughout the communities.
So nothing in the IRC.
I haven't seen anything.
I don't believe so that it addresses. This is why.
No, the IRC does not address the driveways, is what we've been told. We've also looked at the APWA standards for public works, and they also they talk about slopes in roads and maybe some trails, but not specifically driveways. So we're kind of at a loss here. I think the code in the past has been written to say to kind of treat driveways, private drives, the same as roads and private roads, in that you have the same slope requirements, but they're a little different.
So how do we I don't get it. The problem, because this code is existed last week, visited in 2005, I think you said.
The standards.
Yeah. So, yeah, we have, that was like numerous houses in our city that don't that exceed 12%.
Okay. No, the okay. So, this is a really good point. In the past, when we've seen a code compliant, when we've seen a driveway come in that's not compliant, many times the previous building official started this saying, okay, well, you're gonna have to put steps in, and many people put steps in. But really, when the push came, there's nothing that says you have to put steps in.
I'm getting at is a percentage.
So there's a lot of people that have a driveway that, I guess what I'm getting at is there's a lot of people that have a driveway that's not compliant, but they already have steps. There's many people that put in a driveway and put in the steps because they were asked to. They got their certificate of occupancy, and then they ripped the steps out. So it goes both ways.
Yeah, I'm not talking about steps now. I'm just talking about driveways, because the code says 8 to 12%, but we have houses that have up to 30%.
A house. Okay. Only one.
I've heard a couple of examples of driveways, so.
I would go measure those slopes, though.
Yeah. You mentioned a moment ago that, you know, they're ready to catch in and they want their occupancy, right? I'm assuming that we're in the city, we're like,
I can speak to the one that we just dealt with, in that they were notified of potential driveway issues 14 months in advance of putting their CFO in, or asking for their CFO.
Yeah.
Despite that, their contractor did not put the foundation at the correct depth, which... The inspector catches that and misses it, but you know, you only have so much teeth. And I'm not going to ask somebody to rip out their brand new house. So we see the problems, but we don't have a whole lot of solutions. So what we're asking for is let us create a solution here.
Helps me, at least it's two-part.
Yeah.
It's mitigating standard and also approval standard. As to whether it's 8% or 12%, I just don't know what to say. In the absence of some sort of standard code, that we say code.
The text on this, the verbiage on this says, the city council may approve the grade above. Anything above 8 has to go to city council. That's the way it's written.
That's kind of the threshold, yeah. But we have sections of driveway that are above 12 even. So that's where we're getting into the public safety concern.
Right. I'm just saying that the 8, well, if it's above 8, it's got to be approved. I think that's a given. And then the mitigated one. Okay,
if you're
mitigating
this,
then
we have
that
step.
Here it is in the code.
Well, we may have a homeowner that shows us that there's a way to achieve 12%, but then go to 14-15%. And that's when maybe this other mitigating thing kicks in. And we can talk further about it. Does that automatically kick in? 8% would automatically kick in above 12%, and they way to exceed 12%.
Well, referring to city code, anything above that, we have to go to the city.
Anything above 8?
Yes.
Yeah.
Let me discuss. But at least now the provisions, you'll have a little more teeth in terms of, okay, even if we find out after the fact, not homes that are already existing, but prior to CLO, we can find out that they have proceeded when they were approved, then we have some teeth to enforce additional.
I noticed that I don't even know how practical this is with new build, but in a couple of places that I've been, they have had these situations with the slope of the building, where they've been able to put the driveway, the garage in more of a flat situation, and then have this, the more steep steps going up to the front door. And so, I mean, we'd have to be involved with the excavation, but I know there's even a place up on the hill across Canyon Road where that's the case, Colonial there, where they have to drive the kind of one more straight in this pretty steep steps, quite a few of them going up to the front door. That's always an alternative if myself and Porter are willing to do it.
And when these do come in as building commands, we don't design them for them. We only approve them. So that's basically our role, is when they turn in the design, we can't create it. So they're the ones that will design it, bring it to us, and then we can say, hey, you know, we've got things to meet this. So, let's say you go back to his step saying, hey, this is over. Like particular, if they bring a site plan in, on the site plan, I require that they indicate slope on the driveway, the width, everything on the driveway that they bring this in. So this original plan that came in, that Chandler was talking about, met all of those. But after they poured it, they submitted an alternative site plan that comes to the driveway. So, that's the problem with the building.
Okay. All right, we'll move on to item 7, discussion on building heights for accessory structures. All right, some of you guys were on the planning commission anyway, we passed this code, and I don't know what the outcome was here, but it doesn't reflect, I think, what we talked about. So, let me remind you, what we talked about is in the R120,000 zones, big half-acre lots, that when the lot exceeded the half-acre, when it was a big lot, that they could put an accessory structure that was greater than the maximum height of the lot at the time, 20 feet. We said for every foot you go up in elevation, you have to go another 2 feet away from property line. That was the consensus, as I recall. Anyone want to correct me on that or set me straight? That was the way I interpreted
something along those lines.
Yeah.
Well,
yes.
In reviewing the code that was adopted, it doesn't read like that. So, it only allows 5 more feet. It just allows 5 more feet. It doesn't talk anything about a 2-to-1 ratio. It talks about lots that are.
Can I ask, is the code that was published in the Surrey Code of Fires?
There might be some updates that haven't occurred, but I think that they're pretty much a favorite.
Mm-hmm. If it's not in the code, at least you can click on and see the ordinance that was passed.
Usually, when you pull up a certain codifier, if you look at the table of contents on that, there's usually a pending ordinance. I don't believe that there are any. So I guess
this says ordinance is referred to 1998-2004.
The paragraph I'm looking at is 10.4b-8c, and it was done in March of 2018. Look at the ordinance number for section C there, that 10.4b is a void, dash 8, it says building requirements, and then there's C, it says height of the building, and this ordinance was passed in March of 2018. And I'm just saying that the language here,
it says 10.4A8C also refers to five accessory buildings.
There's many. Yeah. Every 10.4 inserted letter will all talk about high accessory buildings. We're only talking about one zone, that was 10.4B. Where we have a large half acre lots. Anyway, I guess my point is, and I can be quick about this, is that code as it's passed here does not meet the recollection that I have of what the intent was. Now, the reading of it says the maximum height of any accessory building should be 20 feet to the ridge line of the roof.
An additional 5 feet from building height may be granted by the zoning administrator for lots exceeding the minimum square footage required by factor 2. Should the proposed accessory building comply with this building setback requirements for the main building in the underlying zone? It doesn't talk about that. For every foot in height you get, you have to move your building an additional 2 feet back the setback.
Well, I think that's what the setback requirement was here, because accessory building doesn't have to meet the setback requirements, right?
The
main dwelling setback.
The accessory building does not have to meet the setback requirement, right? Because it can be located up 5 feet away from the property.
Right.
So you're saying your neighbor could have placed their 25-foot barn at this point 5 feet away from the property.
No, they can put their 20-foot barn 5 feet away. If you want to get to a 25, you then have to comply with the building setback requirements of the main dwelling.
Right.
But
so are you okay with the code here? We need to change this.
Well, what's prompting these public coming in?
There's no applications to see you, it was just registered today.
Yeah, it's just applications that do come in.
We haven't had an application
yet. So if I understand this right, if the lot area is twice the minimum, then if their accessory dwelling meets the setback requirements for the main dwelling, as it currently reads, you can get up to an additional 5 feet in height, not to exceed 25 feet overall. That seems to ring a bell to me.
Does that sound right to you?
I thought we talked about the accessory.
If you don't want to clarify this, I'm fine. We can look at the consequences.
If you do a 2-to-1, then that accessory structure can keep growing.
No, it's a limited up. It's limited up to 5 feet in additional height for an additional 10 feet to setback.
Oh. I thought you wanted to do a
cap at 25. We've never wanted
25-foot cap is what I remember.
Yeah.
You're saying
it's how they get there and then where the building's in place.
So it should say up to an additional 5 feet.
Yeah. On a one.
So I think if it's right there, I think there's just some clarifying language here that is.
So you want to say the meets the minimum setback requirements, they can add an additional foot for every 2 additional feet. Beyond the setup.
Well, if you're okay with keeping it as a building envelope, that was what we passed, but maybe my recommendation is off. Or I don't see if they can change the building. I guess what we want to prevent is the ability to put a 25-foot building 5 feet.
Right, and in this particular zone, the accessory structure for the main building has to be 1 to 5 feet on the front.
Yes.
So if your accessory structure has to follow the same setback requirements.
So that your accessory structure could be 12 feet off the property line.
Is that what the main building setback is?
Depends on the subdivision.
I don't have an issue with 5 feet personally.
5 feet, 25 feet is pretty tall.
The reason I'm having a problem is your building can be 35 feet tall and it has to be in the building overall.
At that point, you're not going to be talking about. You're from 12 to 20.
I'm only talking about situations where any structure is being built inside the main dwelling envelope. So you have all the setbacks are in play for your main dwelling. Mm-hmm. So I've got this envelope. I can put my house anywhere I want in that envelope, and I'm going to be 35 feet high.
Correct.
But you're saying I can put an accessory structure in that same envelope, but it can only be 20 feet high.
25.
Well, we're saying 25 here, but I don't see how that's any more onerous than putting the main building on there. It's less.
Even you're right.
If I'm a neighbor on this side, the main building could be over here. If I'm a neighbor on this side, the main building could be here. The accessory structure is not 10 feet shorter than the main building.
But that doesn't capture the idea of maximizing your unavailable space on your large lot. If you want the accessory outside of that building envelope,
then you only get 20 feet.
Unless you have a big enough lot to justify the kicker. And that's where we started with this whole discussion.
Right, so if you have a lot, you should be able to build a bigger accessory building.
Yeah, I recall that.
And that's in here. That's in.
Not exactly, because it's putting it in the main building. I think 5 and 25 is big, and I think 10 and 25 is acres. Let's be the big that you should allow for 5 and 25, like a property owner. Building for him to use the property. I don't
to see if it differs between 5 more feet and the impact of that.
Well, it does incentivize them to move inward off their site so that they can build a taller building back there.
Five feet, which is 25 feet, 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 25 feet,
12 feet away.
And they're going to be 35 feet high.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm upset. It matters. But in this case, we're already saying you have to see twice the 50,000. So you have to be 30,000 square foot lot. You can consider this section.
As we look at the land,
10 feet. It's 10 feet. It's 10 feet at least?
10 feet.
Pretty close.
In my neighborhood, 5 feet makes a difference.
In your neighborhood,
5 feet makes a big difference. It makes a huge difference. So, I mean, if you keep in mind that we're in this network, that we're trying to incentivize folks with larger lots to zero something to advantage. We're saying, let's not, if you want to build your accessory structure and follow the rules of the main building instead of an accessory building, the incentive is there because you can build a taller building. I don't know if we need to do the 2-to-1.
I don't think so. You know. So if it's 10 feet, we're doing 1-to-1, right?
Not yet.
But it doesn't say 1-to-1. You just get the extra 5 feet.
Yeah.
And if you're going above 20 feet,
you go, you're going above 20 feet, you have to be 10 feet.
If we're 10 feet, you're probably going to set up.
That's essentially what we're saying.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't think there's an issue here.
I'm not sure the fact of two language that works.
Probably not. Right, change. So if you have 20,000 in the R1,000 zone, you have a maybe a 10, because if you have put the R1,000 zone, maybe 40,000 square foot lot. Then you have, as I recall, this is, you have the ability to subdivide that lot, and you would have the ability to put 2 35-foot tall structures on it. So that's why you should be able to have a taller accessory structure here as well. Because as John said, it's less of an impact than to have an impact.
It's like five foot home on that.
There's just not here. I guess I'm totally misremembering this guy.
There are lots in the R1 and 11,000 zones that are this size.
Say it again.
Are there any lots in the R1 and 11,000 that are around this size?
Maybe, but it wouldn't apply to me. But I'm saying, I mean, if we have a code, we have about 15,000. Also,
I would be loath to do that because I think that the reason that we were talking about it for R115 is because R10-4B is the R115,000 zone, but it directly references, directly referenced from the R120,000 zone. So we're going to dwell on requirements for the R120,000 zone. So we're going to do the R1. That's why we're missing it here. Because these are still sort of bigger lots in the city. Even though they're in the R1000 zone, some of them are 3-4 times that big. It just depends on kind of where you are in the city. But I don't know that I would recommend extending this to R1000 zone. Those lots are fairly small.
Also, yeah, can be very small. Maybe it's fine.
There's not many. Most of the R1000. In fact, there's many R11,000 lots that are below the 11,000 square foot threshold. So, the difference between 11,000 square feet and their 9,000 to 10,000 square feet made up in open space dedications around them. But it's they're not all that big. They're small lots. sort of the R20,000 zone, there's nothing, no references whatsoever.
No, the R20,000 zone, the dwelling requirements, it's just the same.
My seat is the same.
Same as R15, that's why it's being talked about in R15, which is 10 feet. But maybe there's not an issue, but maybe I'm just reading it wrong. We don't have an application, so this doesn't affect anyone. I just want to make sure you're doing this correctly.
You're asking me to remember something so long ago, and I can't remember what I exactly wanted to
remember. Maybe we can just table this one and say, you know, we don't see this as an issue.
Comments or questions? We'll move on to item 8, discussion on commercial and residential landscaping.
We have talked about this one.
Yeah,
we're specifically talking about the commercial. We're more the residential. Let's talk about the commercial. Because that's really where I want to really get a sense of where we need to go. Because as I recall, you weren't very much in favor of changing anything, keeping it the same.
Well, I just read the minutes, and that's because I wasn't there, but it did seem like the commissioners were reluctant to reduce the 30%.
Reluctant to reduce the 30%. I think that's an accurate statement.
That's how I recall it.
But in what you can put in that 30%, I think there's a lot of room to design.
Right.
Now, okay, then the discussion hinge on that specifically, because we specifically talked about the allowance of escape. But we're not, I think we have to acknowledge that we're not creating park space. We're not creating if you go for a commercial zone, and you look at Walmart's open space, and you look at McDonald's open space, it's not places where you can pull over and have a picnic, right? It's just, there are rock basins, retention basins, there's a grass retention basin, but for the most part, it's just, the park strip has tree. So, these aren't usable areas. I think that's what the council is really getting at. So there's a way to conserve water or to promote the conservation of water, then let's take advantage of that, not try to create this park space atmosphere that we know isn't coming. Because why would they use 30% of their commercial land fields? So do it in a way that promotes conservation. Where it's not being used for. So, for example, and I know that in Gateway, we have where the retention basin is on the corner there, that's grass. But as it goes behind the fence, and then behind your home, it's not grass. It's rock. Because we recognize that's not usable land. You really want people hanging out back there anyway.
No, but honestly, the manager there, and I wouldn't want to have to mow that, worry about that, and no one sees.
Yes. So I think that's what we're trying to come up with. So expanding the ability to do zero scape, expanding the ability to, or recognizing that other forms of landscaping exist that are grass. We also don't want to do stamped concrete and have you take the carbon burn, because we don't get that.
Yeah. But so where they can use gravel, and I was thinking about this, but driving around through Highland, around the Wendy's area, you can see how much rock and DRC is in there. Mm-hmm. But do they actually put irrigation there to keep those trees alive, or?
We have to put the drain system, yeah. The city
okay.
Has a drain system.
All right.
So the trees, that's your question, but the trees behind you, they will be irrigated, but it's not going to be sprinkled.
Right, okay.
So you're not ever going to see them going on.
Okay. But I mean, so if it looks to resemble something around the rocks and the, they have different kinds of rocks, and even if you're escaping around people like your Wendy, and is that the builders are reluctant, the developers are reluctant to even do 30% of that?
30% is a challenge because you're taking a great, think about the commercial zone that's left in Gateway, right? 30% of that is 3 acres. That's a
to a couple of retail businesses. I don't have a problem with 30% personally. I like the open space, and I figure the developers are comfortable with moving it into the community investment. So I just thought of that.
I
went at it the wrong way, but that's just.
So you're saying it's not coming because it's not business friendly to have to do that. But we did an original plan to do this, wasn't it, to have it more like a walk full of really park, but not concrete all the way.
No, we don't want concrete. We don't want that.
But you want something less.
So you want something to visually break up the commercial area from the building and have nice aesthetics and landscaping there. But I guess the question I have is, can you do that? Can you achieve that visual look and impression of less than 30%?
Because
look at Walmart, right? Where's their 30%? We're counting with Walmart, and if you actually count landscaping in Walmart, they're not at 30% because they count the stamped concrete, right? So you're not at 30%. That's the visual representation that we have at 30% because they don't want to look at it. They don't want areas to maintain. They don't want to have higher landscapers come in and spend hours every week to maintain it. In fact, if you look at Walmart's grass at the end of the summer, it looks pretty dead. But this is something that I think businesses struggle with, really, is at 30%. Because they're looking for other ways to get to that 30% threshold without having to increase their maintenance costs at the facility. Because we're already requiring a high level of structure. So their returns are already lower because we're saying your building's got to be brick. So already the cost of increased that. Then you add in facility maintenance of 30% of what we have is landscaping, and it increases even more. So yeah, it looks nice, but I fear that we're maybe creating an environment where they're looking for any way to get around that.
So does every single tree in the parking lot count towards that region?
Yeah.
My experience is whether it's 15%, 20%, 30%, seems to me all commercial property owners struggle to keep their properties up. At the state, there's just some property owners who just all aren't in that, regardless of the percentage. I don't think it's a matter of, well, it's 30%, so I can't keep care of this.
So I mean, you could think about, I guess you could think about saying, okay, we're going to take it from 30%, we're going to take it down to 20%, but we're not going to count hardscape. It has to be 20%, and it has to be some type of landscaping material.
When we had in the gateway, we had the developers specifically plan our site. I can't do this, or I don't want this yet. 30%, I can't develop this yourself, so that's not happening.
Oh yeah. No, but at the same time, we're asking them to help us with the upgrade to Cedar Canyon, that retention basin is going to be rock. That's going to be grass. And we're saying to the gateway, look, if you help us make this grass, we'll count this 20%.
Oh, yeah, I'm going to look at it.
And that's something it's totally to their advantage to do that because, yeah, they pay us one-time cost to help us pay the delta from the rock to grass, but in the end, it's a city retention basin. We're maintaining it, but they get credit for it. So it's a total win for them. It's also a total win for the city because it's not a problem.
I'm just thinking of the general plan. I know we've visited that for a while, but the whole premise of our commercial community, the general plan was for it to be a walkable community type atmosphere that was placed people together and that really hasn't come to fruition yet. But if we now advocate 30% some of the numbers, it's definitely. So I'm I personally, I like the side, not in the side of the developers, but rather the side of Cedar Hills. And what we want until some time where we have developers say, no, I can't sell this. Maybe that updated impact of the 30% standard. Yeah, I guess what we have. That seems like.
Yeah, market for what it's worth, I agree. We, a while ago, years ago, we kind of master planned that whole area with one developer, and we looked, and it was meant to look more like what they were just described, and we've kind of gotten away from that and broken it up into smaller pieces that are being developed by individual. So it's not really an overall master plan, except from a street and infrastructure and sidewalk standpoint. So we are kind of losing that flavor and goal that we were after initially to try and make it easier for developers and encourage folks to come in. We're not asking, we're not requiring that they take the whole site and develop the whole site. We're allowing individual development here and there. But I'm afraid if we also start to give in on our landscaping, that we're just continuing down our path.
How high is that percentage of the 30%? How much is that percentage?
Which 30? Yeah. In 10 cases, so you're still sort of quite a bit. So you should be done like that, maybe. But you're not going to look at the rear areas, you're not going to look at the site and say, walk right through it, and then about 2.5 acres of landscaping there. Because it's massive, it's hidden, and that's the way that it's done in the past for McDonald's and Walmart. So, let me ask this. Leaving the 30% alone, what about changing the threshold for xeriscape to allow it to constitute more than that 30%?
What I was going to ask is, I'm looking at all this, the code, what's written here, approved trees, this and that. I mean, I'm looking at these approved trees, and none of these are being tied. They take a lot of water. These are trees that we have in Michigan where we got, 30-something inches of water, rainy here, and they grew great. We don't
they
get
struggle
that
here.
Yeah, they have to be here. So increasing the percentages of light can still look good. I don't want xeriscaping to be a bunch of gray rock.
No, and that's why when the plan comes to you, you see the landscaping plan, and
right.
It's just on a piece of paper, and it's got a digital representation of what it's going to be in real life. But you have to take the time to kind of imagine what that would look like. And I've seen really good ones, and I've seen really bad ones.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you guys can tell the difference. But with the trees, it might be too late to even do anything about that, because if we can talk about along certain roadways going east-west, there's going to be a certain type of tree. And even certain roadways going north-south, there's going to be another certain type of tree. And I don't think that the city's always helped to that. In fact, I think along as you drive in off North Pine Boulevard into Parts, that road there, the existing one. Those trees are not the ones that are called out for along for east-west roads. And so when the next developer came in and said, hey, your code says plant tree A here, but you've clearly planted tree B, what do you want me to do? And you said, okay, well, plant tree B, so it looks like it's close to, like it continues. But I do think that if you're not going to play with the 30%, I do think you have to give on the xeriscape of outdoors.
I just want to add that I'm not against reducing the 30%. I want to kind of see it flat map and kind of see where it can be reduced and still use it. But I'm also not against doing the higher percentage of xeriscape.
And it was a unique example in that we told them that while each individual site may not be at 30%, the overall percentage, we're putting our stamp of approval on the final one, has to be 30%, so the final court. They haven't balked at that. Now, we're just looking at it and saying, for the state legislature, which is down session, you see on the bill,
state continually evaluates water, and specifically cities use water, and we're supposed to be accountable for every drop that comes into our system. We have to be able to report this to the state where it all goes. Are we creating an environment that wastes water down here, or that serves water? And the city council is looking at this beyond just the commercial area. I mean, if you look at, drive down Cedar Hills Drive, there are certain phone calls I know I'm going to get every year. And one of them is, first snowfall, I'm going to get a lot of snow. I'm going to get a lot of complaints about snowfall. Just that's the way it is. First snowfall always happens. Also, when the sprinkler system is shut down, I know that when it rains and I have sprinklers going along Cedar Hills Drive in that park strip, I know I'm going to get a call. I just know. And people say, well, why don't you go have somebody turn that off? Well, that sprinkler timer is going to run for 15 minutes. It's going to take you somebody 20 minutes to go down there and turn it off, and then another 20 minutes to go turn it back on. So it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to go turn those off. What does make sense is to evaluate those strips and say, should these be zero scale? So as a city, we're looking at that as well. And trying to lead out on some level, but it's got to be done in a way that, because this is our corridor of both as people see here, so it's got to be done in a way that is nice.
It's still attractive, it's still nice, but does it need much more?
Do pines require less water?
Pines? How water is the same, I don't know.
I mean, the reason I asked when I drove in from Ohio, Cedar Hills, and all I saw were trees from Michigan and Ohio including all over my neighborhood. First thing I did was plant pine trees in the yard and started pulling rocks from where I was traveling around my own to bring some of that mountain down into where I live. I love pines. I wish we would plant more pines. I wish we had more of that mountain feel here. When I read our design guidelines, bless their heart, I didn't understand it at all, but it was what the vision of the city fathers is, right? That's why I like this facility we're in right now. It has more of that mountain aesthetic that I enjoy. I just wonder if another step toward saving water could be introducing new trees and building plants.
Is that something, I mean, could we do a lot of evergreen trees to be in the commercial zone?
All along behind Walmart.
Yeah, there's there. I don't know why they're typically not selected as much. I don't know if it's a cost differential between that and the other types of trees that we allow.
I don't know. I'm thinking out loud.
But you're right. And it's been said multiple times that maybe the palette of trees needs to be revisited in terms of allowing more native trees that we know can get by on less water than some of these other ones. Maybe that's right.
I will say my idea is for less water than other trees. So Sam, can I challenge you with something so easy? So you talked about how at present you're not requiring the developers to be 30%.
No.
But at the end, hold on. At the end, you want 30% to 30% last piece.
Hold on. Let me clarify. Is that, like, you have, imagine Gateway. You're familiar with the Gateway plat, right? Mm-hmm. So the Taco Bell site is a small portion of the overall Gateway. And we always talk about the 30%, but let me keep in mind that it's 30% net roads. Like, back the roads out, what's left, that's 30% of that. So it's really probably less than 30, maybe something like 2. Nonetheless, the Taco Bell site, let's say that they come in and they put in landscaping and they only do 15% of their little section there,
right,
is landscaped. Well, let's say that the storage unit is 35%. As the numbers go, we look at that overall percentage and say, okay, by the end, you should be at 30%,
right.
Including this retention basin. So here you have a half acre basically credit in landscaping that you're getting. And so yeah, you can take some of that credit and apply it to the Taco Bell and
that differential is maybe made up in some of that retention basin. So
I thought where I thought Kirby say was the very last piece of the catch-up piece.
It could be.
And that's up to them, and that's my concern is that if there's too much,
so maybe you will get
it. Never even developed. I know, like in my neighborhood, there's an empty lot. That's the lot that the developer has all the beans on. All the houses, and there's no incentive for him to sell it.
Yeah.
You know, so the lot is successfully there, and it's full of lean. So I'm just concerned. I just want, like, this at the end, like, oh, you know, because we haven't done a good percent along the way, this last piece, such some open space that was
by never going to develop. That's a good point.
So that's fine. That's
what I think that's something that as we have applications coming for us, I think that's something that we continually look at, say, okay, where are we at?
Right.
We're on that overall density, not just this one slice of pie. I remember that. A developer, a commercial developer that wants to put in a building kind of in the middle of the big top development and storage unit. And yeah, when that comes before you, let's talk landscape.
All right.
It's a small piece though, so don't expect a huge amount of landscape.
I withdraw my challenge.
Okay.
Appreciate it. Just a final comment here. For example, underneath where we're talking about what trees. Immediately underneath the paragraph C of the landscape. And Kentucky bluegrass are equivalent mix shall form the ground cover for all portions of the landscape strip. No shrubs, bushes, ground cover, flower beds, finer areas, rock, or other such landscaping materials shall be allowed within the landscaping strip. You're saying use water heavy stuff there. That's it. There's no other way to read that. Say Utah's got a lot of that.
Use grass. Grass is water.
Kentucky bluegrass are equivalent. I mean, that's not even. You know, there's other grasses that use less than that, but all grass uses a ton of water. So if you find something that is attractive, it still looks good, but it's not.
So that's a good point. I think rather than if we leave the 30% unchanged, but we say if you go through and we allow for
different types of
trees. So we're seeing, you're seeing the heavy water use, you're adjusting the language there to allow for. Or is there escape more?
Maybe Walmart. Walmart has zero escape portions.
They do have zero escape in some
portions. Those rocks all in the parking lot.
So if they're planting under 5 feet, it says new planting shall be protected with organic cover. I would imagine that means mulch. But should it also be allowed for rock?
Yeah.
Is rock organic? I'm just saying.
Really encourage different types of landscaping that are native, low water usage, and possibly even zero water usage, because rock mulch can look nice instead of
It
stays in beds unlike Walmart, instead of what's just picking up all over the parking lot.
Did you mention that the city is going to their models about this, or will they sell water about this?
Water usage?
Yeah.
We don't go through an audit per se. We do have annual reports that the state Department of Water Use requires us to file, one of them being our culinary usage. So we have to report on how much we pump out of the ground and how much is used by the city. So that's all metered. We know how much we're using it. The state now is requiring us to also report our usage for secondary water. That's more challenging because we know in a roundabout way, because it comes from multiple sources, we have central regional water, we have canyon water, we have culinary water that's pumped into our secondary system. But they want an audit for that. The problem is when you turn on your sprinklers, I don't know how much you use. Right, so it passes through some meters initially in the system, and I know how much we pump. But with pond liners leaking, with breaks in the system, you're sitting on gravity. There could be a leak in the system, and I never ever know about it. There was a leak in the system somewhere in the city, I won't say where, but they use tons of water. Tons of water. Unbelievable amounts of water. And when they finally found it, we had to, and they fixed it, we had to adjust our budget number by about $10,000 because we weren't getting that money anymore. Because they were using less water, which is good. Because then we also knew we're not pumping that water. Because there's a huge pumping cost because we have to pump it all the way up the hill, only to have it come all the way back down. So it's a unique situation. But yeah, it's not so much an audit as just an annual report.
It increases the water pressure when it goes back down.
I know, which is ridiculous. You're going to get me on a soapbox here, and I apologize. But yeah, we have to pump it all the way up the hill, and we have to pump it so high up the hill because we have to go over a fault line where we originally wanted to put the tank. And then it's so high up on the hill that in order to get it back down, we have to run through a PRV, a pressure reducing valve, or else it'll blow everyone's system. So, yeah.
Yeah.
It's frustrating.
Okay. Got it.
Any other comments, questions? I'll second the motion. All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you for your attention.